Hello, and welcome to our program, Smithsonian, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Margie Lohoff, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Smithsonian Magazine here on OWL Radio. As I've described in the past, Smithsonian Magazine is pretty unique in the nature of the topics that it covers. So many different topics and categories, including history and geography or sports or justice or medicine issues, anthropology, you name it. And today we are going to start out with an article that has to do somewhat with geography and even hydrometry, because we are in such a water shortage these days. And this is discussing a little bit about that. The name of the article is Glen Canyon Reveals Its Secrets. Water woes threaten America's second largest reservoir, but leave new vistas in their wake. And this was written by Pete McBride. He starts out, "At dusk, the bats appear in the ghost forest that surrounds us, blackened tree trunks encrusted with a white coating. These cottonwood and willow groves are long dead, but amazingly still upright after more than half a century underwater. I am camped on the fickle shoreline of Lake Powell, the second largest reservoir in the United States after Lake Mead. Once a vacation destination visited by 2 million people annually, as a kid I learned to water ski there during family visits in the 1980s, Lake Powell is today just a hint of its former self, littered with stranded boat ramps and even entire abandoned marinas. Instead of a recreation idol, it's a symbol of water troubles in the West and the impact of climate change. Lake Powell has been shrinking for a number of reasons. The Colorado River system, which feeds both Lake Powell and Lake Mead, supplies drinking water to more than 40 million Americans, and in winter, much of the country's salad bowl. 7 states draw water from the river system, according to allocations set in 1922, and it has since become clear that early 20th century officials overestimated the amount of water available to allocate. As a result, too much water has been consumed for too long. In addition, for 2 decades, a mega drought has depleted the Colorado River and its reservoirs, and less annual snowpack in the Rocky Mountains to the east has made things worse. Around the time I visited Lake Powell this past April, it had fallen to 24% of capacity and was decreasing a half inch a day. The water stored in Lake Powell is also a source of power, with turbines in the river downstream of the massive Glen Canyon Dam generating electricity that helps power some 3.2 million homes. Water experts and the Bureau of Reclamation have predicted the lake may drop so low that by 2023 there will not be enough water to spin the turbines. Water managers have been trying to avert such a scenario, known as minimum power pool, by releasing water from reservoirs upstream and withholding water from users downstream. The complexities of this Western water puzzle are profound, involving potential threats to energy, drinking water, and agriculture. At the same time, something else is going on. The strikingly beautiful canyon that long existed before engineers dammed the river to create Lake Powell is coming back little by little. John Wesley Powell, who named it Glen Canyon during his survey of 1869, said it was a, quote, land of beauty and glory. I was eager to document that land as it revealed itself. Over 4 days, I hiked and explored some 50 miles of tributaries, much of it in the Escalante drainage. My companions were Eric Balkin, director of the Glen Canyon Institute, a nonprofit devoted to restoring the canyon to its natural state, and a friend of mine named Len Nessefer, a member of the Navajo Nation, and founder and CEO of Natives Outdoors, a native-owned athletic and media company. Everywhere we roamed, we witnessed a wilderness rewilding. Birds and bats darted around, and beavers and bobcats left their marks widely. A freshwater desert orchid, a rare flower I'd never heard of, bloomed along seeps that had been flooded my entire life and appeared only recently. "Look at those," Balkin said with excitement in his eyes. "I didn't expect to see orchids returning so quickly. It almost feels wild again." In one drainage, we walked into an alcove known as the Cathedral in the Desert, which boasted a waterfall trickling down through a gap in an overhang hundreds of feet above us. I sat in awe, thinking about how such natural wonders had been underwater my entire life. In our camp, the detritus of other times surrounded us. Pull-tab beer cans, flippers, lawn chairs, golf balls, anchors, a pair of pliers, sunglasses, jet skis, and even sunken boats. A time capsule of the lake's history. But up the side canyons where monsoon rains have worked away at the layers of silt and debris, slowly starting to wipe away the white bathtub ring that reminds us where the lake once stood, nature is returning. And with it, many remarkable alcoves, arches, and overhangs that equal or surpass those in the Grand Canyon. Some still contain the archaeology of ancient Puebloan rock structures, or steps cut into the sandstone that once served as ladders. Edward Abbey, the writer and environmental pioneer, visited the canyon before it was flooded and described it as a, quote, portion of Earth's original paradise. The diminishment of Lake Powell is a tragedy for countless Americans who, like me, created wonderful family memories there, and the loss of water is a matter of grave concern to people and businesses downstream who depend on the water stored there. Yet we can also marvel at the beauty of the landscape as it reasserts itself. There are lessons to be learned for sure. Lessons about our relationship to nature. Lessons about time. My friend Nessefer, sitting on a shore that was underwater not long ago, looking up at the towering orange canyon walls, mentioned one of them. "Nature bats last," he said. So there is always a positive to a situation in the lack of water that is very fearsome and dangerous for a lot of people. And I wish I could describe the photos that accompany this article. The colors and striations in the walls of these canyons is quite spectacular. So there's always something positive to be seen. We know our lakes here near San Antonio are a fraction of what they generally are. Lake Medina is down to about 6%, I want to say. Canyon Lake is also considerably reduced. So it's not just in the West. Well, our next article has a more optimistic title. It's Ray of Hope. And the subtitle is Heroes of the Wild. This was an article written by Terence Monmani. Conservationists aim to save the giant fish, which faces threats from poachers and climate change. There's a little bit more about ecology. For a reef manta ray, like this one swooping in the Indian Ocean near the Maldives, motion is life. Like many shark species, a manta ray must constantly move to avoid sinking and to keep oxygen-rich water flowing across its gills. And because it is a very large animal that depends on a very small, even microscopic food source, plankton, the fish has to eat virtually all the time. Swimming through a plankton cloud, it opens its massive mouth, deploys special fins to funnel the seawater in, and filters out the tiny morsels with its comb-like gill plates. Those plates made of cartilage are lately a source of trouble. Poachers are killing reef manta rays to supply quacks who peddle the material in a bogus remedy. That practice, plus deliberate killing of the fish for food, unintentional capture in nets, boat strikes, and other threats, have reduced world populations. Climate change looms as another challenge. The International Union for Conservation of Nature classifies the reef manta ray as vulnerable. Worry is justified. In the Sea of Cortez, aggressive overfishing wiped out local populations of two reef manta ray cousins, the oceanic manta ray and the devil ray, in just 20 years. Conservation groups are spurring research into the slow-growing giant, which can stretch 20 feet, can stretch 12 feet wingtip to wingtip. That was 12 feet, weigh 1,500 pounds, and live up to 40 years. It's a species that doesn't have any way of adapting to survive human pressures, says Joanna Harris, a researcher at Manta Trust, a UK-based nonprofit. The only way to halt the decline is to take action. Harris, a doctoral candidate at the University of Plymouth, is working to understand environmental cues that prompt the fish to migrate, sometimes hundreds of miles, in search of food. How does it know where to go next and when? A change in wind direction, which affects surface currents, appears to play a role. She says government officials, conservationists, and scuba outfitters who lead reef manta ray watching trips could all use such information to benefit the animals. Protections seem to be effective in the Maldives, where catching reef manta rays is prohibited, and rangers limit access to certain lagoons when the animals aggregate to feed. The island chain plays host to the world's largest population of the majestic fish, with more than 5,000 individuals counted. The dark spot pattern on the underside of each one is unique and serves as an ID. The reef manta ray, according to a Manta Trust database, can be a juvenile male in the photograph accompanying this article. His name is Naba. So hopefully there are enough steps being taken soon enough to protect this magnificent fish, the reef manta ray. Our next article is a little bit different. It's concerning one of our senses, a very important sense, and the name of this article is Sense and Sensibility, and that is S-C-E-N-T-S. So, let's think about our noses. From the lab to the art gallery, the latest efforts to understand the fragrant, musky, stinky, and utterly baffling world of smell. And this is an article written by Abigail Tucker. Curious. And there is a photograph of different samples of smells in little jars that are labeled, and they go from roasted and cheesy, fishy, rotten decay, fatty, vanilla, floral, chlorine, mushroom. Oh, so many scents. There are so many others here, too. Of course, we couldn't begin to name them all. Here goes the article and what she has to say. Last winter, Andreas Keller decided the time was right to branch out from his day job as a neuroscientist and launch a new art gallery. Not just any gallery, but the country's first and only commercial space devoted entirely to smell-based art. He rented a defunct barbershop in New York City's Chinatown and teamed up with an artist named M. Dougherty for his inaugural show in February of 2021, drilling a hole in the exterior wall to pipe a piney perfume called Forest Bath to the street outside. The fresh evergreen, mingled with steamed dumplings and ripe dumpsters and the smoldering papers that Keller's Chinese neighbors sometimes burned as an offering to their ancestors. The gallery had always been a fantasy, but the pandemic brought it into focus, says Keller, sitting in his astroturf-carpeted back office, which he soon plans to sprinkle with a molecule that smells like fresh-cut grass. Not only did lockdown allow contemplative hours away from his work, but one of early COVID-19's telltale symptoms gave him the hunch that there might at long last be a market for his dream. Olfaction has always been our underdog sense. It's both primitive and complex, which makes it hard to study and harder still to transfer to our increasingly digital existence. Our scientific understanding of how smell works lags so far behind our grasp of hearing and, of course, especially vision, and smells cannot at this point be recorded or emailed or Instagrammed. In one 2011 survey, more than half of young adults admitted that they would rather forfeit their ability to smell than their smartphones. Wow. But just when it seemed that the nose could not recover from its nosedive, along came the coronavirus. Afflicted people, robbed of their sense of smell, realized that they couldn't register the smoke of fires actively burning down their houses or the scent of their spouses torpedoing marriages by some accounts, or even the savor of a candy bar, since many of what we think of as tastes like the flavor of chocolate are actually smells that stank. You don't know what you have until it's gone, Keller says. Even for those who avoided loss of smell, living in a world muffled by masks or reduced to deodorized Zoom calls heightened the collective desire to breathe deep and experience the scented realm anew. This likely explains the current perfume and home fragrance boom, and perhaps why so many curious passers-by step inside Olfactory Art Keller, as the gallery is called. When you are asked to smell art, Keller says, you realize how impoverished your perception of the world is when you limit yourself to the visual. Of course, for many of our listeners, that is not an option, and the sense of smell has become increasingly more keen as a result. For several weeks, the gallery's windows were tinfoiled over to allow a full immersion in the aroma of old banana versus young banana, one artist's wink at a classic Velvet Underground album cover, or the visitor may get a whiff of a perfumer's interpretation of what a beaver might smell like to a dog. Marzipan, maybe? Or the orchid bee's homemade cologne? Or George Washington's false teeth? During my visit, I'm instructed to massage a rainforest landscape that turns out to be a sort of giant scratch-and-sniff sticker, unleashing a sudden rush of microencapsulated citrus, like jungle breath. Some people get very confused, Keller says. Normally, game gallery hoppers may back out onto the street. Then there's always somebody who can't smell anything and thinks it's a prank. A few bananaphobes came out of the woodwork during the banana stunt, the fruity smell triggering some deep and unexplained revulsion. I am actually friends with one of these people, Keller notes. She moves to a different table if someone is eating a banana, and she refused to come to that show. Those visitors willing and able to stay and ponder a scent by the name of sinner often bicker about what it is they're smelling. Is that hospital disinfectant? Church incense? No, tandoori chicken. These diverse personal responses are exactly what Keller has devoted much of his academic life to studying. Why various individuals seem to perceive the same odors differently or interpret the same odors in different ways. Or not notice some of them at all. Such questions are at the heart of the larger problem of how smells are coded by the brain. How, for example, do a bunch of snorted up proteins and carbohydrates result in our tangy awareness of just-baked sourdough, that pandemic crowd-pleaser? Perhaps scientists will soon catch wind of the answers, as the pandemic has also brought a flood of new funding to this sometimes overlooked or perhaps undersniffed field. The future could be a heady place, characterized not only by redolent art galleries like Keller's, but also by the potential resurrection of technologies like smell-o-vision and the more recently fizzled O-phone. By scent-based strategies to diagnose Parkinson's disease and post-treat post-traumatic stress disorder, by the launch of perfumed dating apps and fragrant Instagram food pictures and virtual shopping servers that can sniff out the ripest avocado from afar. Most urgently, tens of millions of otherwise recovered COVID-19 patients are still suffering from lasting olfactory problems. Many of these people are understandably discontented with the conventional wisdom that once a sense of smell disappears for 6 months, it's probably gone for good, and are now demanding new and better clinical approaches. The amount of research has just gone up exponentially, says Richard Doty, director of the University of Pennsylvania's Smell and Taste Center. It's a pretty big deal in terms of interest. But this is a complicated sensory system. Understanding it is pretty difficult. I don't think overnight we are going to have all the answers. Progress in this field may depend on unusual creativity and collaborations between perfumers and linguists, artists and engineers, and even perhaps anthropologists and foraging communities that have never before encountered a whiff of vanilla or camembert cheese. Keller recently completed a PhD in philosophy, which he says complements his genetics PhD. Perception is a philosophical as well as a scientific problem, he said. The truth about smell seems to ambush and retreat, materialize and dissipate, like lilacs on a ticklish June breeze, or the ghost of yesterday's stir-fry. Why don't we know what the nose knows? The fundamentals of color vision were more or less established in the 19th century when scientists discerned that all the varied hues from red to violet are produced by just three types of receptors in human retinas. Taste depends on a whole order of magnitude more receptor types on our tongues, but still a reasonable amount. But the nose, or rather, the clump of sensory neurons high inside your nostrils, boasts about 400 receptor types. In 2004, Richard Axel and Linda Buck were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for discovering the genes that encode these receptors, which sit on the surfaces of specialized neurons, allowing them to shoot information down leggy axons much deeper into the brain, to one of the two olfactory bulbs where smells are processed. But we still can't fathom which odors many of the individual receptors recognize, let alone how they work in concert. If vision is the default sense for Homo sapiens, why do we need so many more olfactory receptors? Seems like too many, doesn't it? One smell researcher acknowledged. Light is electromagnetic radiation, and the same three color vision receptors can combine to produce a wave, a range of wavelengths covering the entire rainbow of visible light. But smells are not wavelengths coasting along a smooth spectrum. They involve a complex mix of chemical particles bobbing around in the air. Our bodies have built receptors that can recognize a number of oddball molecules volatile enough to waft up into our schnozzes, which means we need lots of options. For instance, the dreaded banana smell is a conglomerate of something like 20 or so molecules, each destined for overlapping sets of receptors, activating some and perhaps inhibiting others, and striking all chords in the concerto that we somehow register as banana. In a 2014 paper for Science, Keller and colleagues at Rockefeller University estimated that humans can distinguish, give or take, at least a trillion distinct smells lurking here on planet Earth. That's a trillion. Complicating matters further, our legions of odorant receptors have lots of variants, some of them less sensitive or fully non-functional in large chunks of the population. To begin his smell studies, Keller created mutant fruit flies by turning their olfactory receptors on and off before realizing that his fellow New Yorkers were a sort of naturally occurring population of mutants, and much more diverse since they hailed from all corners of the world. Recruiting subjects via Craigslist and other methods, he administered a battery of smell tests to hundreds of people and collected spit samples for genetic sequencing. The idea was to link specific anosmias, as singular smell deficits are known, anosmias, to corresponding receptors involved in their processing, to figure out which of the 400-ish receptors did what, and why people perceived or preferred certain smells. Once you find people with a non-functioning variant, Keller explains, you can study what that gene does for humans. The upshot is that you can expect about 30% of your receptor arsenal to function differently than your neighbors, which explains why conversations starting with, "Do you smell that?" so frequently devolve into farce. A substance like androstosterone, a musk found in human sweat, truffles, and elsewhere can smell like sandalwood or urine or nothing at all, depending on the nature of the smeller. For a long time, researchers believed that asparagus pea wasn't universal because only certain people reported a malodorous bouquet after consuming the spiky veggie. In fact, only some unlucky noses can detect it, but for those who can, the odor is universal. Even professional perfumers sometimes need a helping nose when it's time to dose the cinnamon, for instance. And I know my husband always said that I was cursed with such a keen sense of smell because it included malodorous versions as well as the pleasant, fragrant ones. Well, it looks like they'll be doing more and more research about the sense of smell, which is interesting, will be very interesting to follow. Well, you have been listening to Smithsonian on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Margie Lohoff saying goodbye from Owl Radio.